Diverse, independent, and yours. CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, Earth Systems, Human Development, Justice, and Science. Today, a conversation with Canadian law professor Michael Link, former UN Special Rapporteur on the human rights situation in the territories occupied by Israel since 1967. It's a dreadful, dreadful situation, as I think everybody who watches and listens to the Green Planet Monitor or pretty much any other web news source knows. 19 months into the conflict, they say that an estimated 55,000 Gazans have been killed, with maybe another 10,000 under the rubble. But we're increasingly seeing the number 200,000 appear, as many as 185,000 or 200,000 may have died since October 7th of 2023, directly killed by U.S. bombs and missiles, or indirectly as the result of disease, starvation, lack of access to medical supplies, and so on. Israel is now talking about totally emptying out the enclave, encouraged by Donald Trump, and a ceasefire is nowhere to be seen. Meanwhile, mayhem in the occupied West Bank, where people are being forcibly transferred, and various quote-unquote refugee camps in places like Jenin and Tulkarm are being leveled, totally bulldozed, gasified, the Israelis say. And then, beyond Israel's extra official borders in Lebanon and Syria, Israel is just routinely launches assaults, drops bombs, assassinates people, so on and so on. So with me to talk about this is Michael Link. Michael Link is a known to you all, emeritus professor of law at Western University in Ontario, and the former UN Special Rapporteur on the human rights situation in the occupied Palestinian territories. He served in that capacity from 2016 to 2022, and is now retired. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you very much for having me back again, David. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
I've painted a very dark picture.
There's no sugarcoating this. This is a very dark moment with respect to the fate of the Palestinians. It's as bad, or if not worse, than what they faced in 1948, 1949. But it's also a dark moment for the rest of us. It's a dark moment with respect to morality in the world, that the nations of the world, and particularly the global north, has immobilized in order to be able to intervene to prevent this genocide. And it's a dark moment for something I hold near and dear, which is international law. Israel, through the conduct of its war, its genocide in Gaza, has set fire to international law. And the United States has provided the petrol and the match for that.
And we've talked about this a lot, Michael, this huge chasm, gulf between Israel's actions, Israel-USA. I refer to it as a single entity. Israel and the United States, in my view, are kind of like conjoined twins. So I refer to them as one, Israel-USA. The gulf between their actions in Gaza and the crimes that have been committed over the last 19 months and international law, and what they are allowed to do with complete impunity, total and complete and utter impunity. And it's shocking and it's horrifying. And aside from the horror of the crimes and the horror of the impunity, is the horror of realizing what the world is. Like, what does it say about the world today? That in the world today, really, international law counts for nothing.
Well, I would hope I can offer glimmers of hope with respect to both where the world is heading, but also with respect to the durability of international law. But you're right, with respect to Israel and international law and the aid given to it by the United States, there doesn't seem to be a red line that can't and won't be crossed with respect to the conduct of this war. We know from interviews that are now undertaken with senior foreign policy advisors of the Biden administration that there were very real concerns raised by more junior officers when the time was coming this time last year as to whether or not the United States was legally obliged to end its arms shipments to Israel because of the very real evidence that war crimes may have been committed, crimes against humanity may have been committed through that time, and also in the background, the specter of genocide being committed. And we know that the U.S. has laws, including in particular the Leahy Law, which prevents America giving sending weapons or providing military assistance to countries that are credibly alleged to have been involved in violations, serious violations of international law. And we know from these discussions and interviews that are now taking place that the senior officials in the United States State Department at the National Security Council were pushing back against the memos and draft reports coming from below and rewriting them in order to be able to continue to have America send military aid and weaponry, advanced weaponry, to Israel in order to allow it to conduct that war. And that's why, in fact, there's been suits raised with respect to the complicity of senior American officials with respect to genocide. This will be looked back upon in years to come as an extraordinary failing in the institutions of international diplomacy. It exposes the weakness in the judicial enforcement of international law, and it obviously stains American foreign policy and will for a long time to come in ways that perhaps are going to rank with the way in which America conducted its wars after 9/11 and the way in which it conducted the Vietnam War in the 1960s and the 1970s. All of this, I think, stains U.S. and in the eyes of the rest of the world, but it also speaks to, you know, the divisions within the rest of the global North, particularly with respect to Europe, and its inability to have any coherence in its foreign policy towards one of the most vital issues that's very close to its front door. And we have the interesting spectacle of this past couple of days of comments made by the former foreign policy mandarin for the European Union,
Josep Borrell
of Spain, who now says this is a genocide. I only wish he had the courage to be able to say that while he was still in office in 2024.
And meanwhile, like today, these last couple of days, the leaders of the most powerful European states, Germany and France and the UK, they're meeting and they're telling Putin, if you don't stop your war, if you don't initiate a ceasefire, we're going to slap the toughest, most comprehensive sanctions on you. And yet, no one talks about sanctions against Israel. There's been talk about, you know, not renewing or suspending the EU-Israeli special agreement, cooperation agreement. And there have been proposals to actually do that. And I gather they're going to be meeting in Brussels to decide on whether or not to do that. But it seems like an open and shut case. They should sanction Israel, but they're not gonna.
Keep in mind this, that Israel is a relatively small country of 9 to 10 million people. It depends heavily on the international community, the global North, both for trade and investment, but also for diplomatic support as well. In many ways, it is much more vulnerable than Russia is with respect to maintaining productive international relations. So a decisive act, either by the global North or in particular by Europe, that would greatly diminish its relationships, its trade and investment relationships, and its diplomatic relationships with Israel, would have an extraordinarily impactful result upon Israeli political decision-making and the way in which it's conducting this particular genocide. And yet none of that, as you indicate, is occurring. Israel has had now virtually cost-free occupation for almost 58 years. And the occupation can only continue, and the occupation can only deepen, because it's facing virtually no meaningful pushback economically or politically or diplomatically from the global north.
And the occupation has been declared illegal by the International Court of Justice in its advisory opinion from last July, and the UN General Assembly ratified that and said, you know, a couple of months later, and then said, Israel's got a year to end its occupation. And so the occupation has been declared illegal by the supreme judicial body of the international community. And yet the European powers, Canada, certainly the United States, continue to extend aid and assistance to it.
Yeah. Here we are almost 8 months into this 12-month deadline. For this resolution that you mentioned that was passed overwhelmingly in mid-September, giving Israel 12 months to end completely and fully its unlawful occupation and withdrawing all of its 740,000 or so Israeli settlers from occupied Palestinian territory. There's been not one single step taken towards that by Israel. Indeed, when Security Council Resolution 2334 was adopted in December 2016, it said that the Israeli settlements are a flagrant violation under international law. It told Israel it had to completely evacuate its settlements, and it gave a direction to the Secretary General of the United Nations to report every 3 months to the Security Council on steps being taken by Israel in order to comply with Resolution 2334. There have been 33 quarterly reports issued by the Secretary General to the Security Council since the beginning of 2017. Not every single one of those 33 reports says that Israel taken no steps at all to halt settlement construction, let alone to start to unwind its massive settlement enterprise in the occupied territories. So with evidence like this, that Israel is a bad faith occupier, that it is conducting, as you said, an unlawful occupation, in the words of the advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice, and that it faces no meaningful headwinds with regards to this. The question then becomes the complicity of the global north, and particularly the United States, but also Europe as well, in maintaining this situation has now led to, you know, what the world sees live streamed every day and every night as this ongoing genocide in Gaza.
Israel needs to be forced to end its war on Gaza. It needs to be forced, and it needs to be forced to end its occupation of the West Bank and East Jerusalem and Gaza. And it's hard to imagine the United States forcing it, although the United States could. Biden, Blinken could have forced it. Forget about prevailing on Israel or pressuring Israel. I always enjoyed hearing in places like Al Jazeera or CNN, the U.S. has just tried so hard to pressure Israel. And what can you do? What can still be done to pressure Israel? I think this is pressuring is absurd. They can and they need to force Israel. And so my question to you is, if somebody were to present themselves to you, Michael, like, I don't know, not the U.S. government or the Canadian government or the, you know, the European Union or one of those forces, and they asked you, what's your agenda or your formula for ending the conflict, you know, aside from pressuring Israel, which really serves no purpose? How do we force them? How do we make them end their war? What would you say?
First of all, we have to accept that Israel is a bad faith occupier, that Israel is in defiance of numerous Security Council resolutions, General Assembly resolutions, resolutions from the UN Human Rights Council, and that it has no right to continue this occupation any longer. Second of all, we have to accept that Israel will take no steps to unwind the occupation and enable Palestinian self-determination unless it is made to do so by the international community in general and the global north in particular. And there's no way that that would wind up happening unless there are sanctions, divestment, boycotts. You heard me, BDS, imposed on Israel. Keep in mind this. We often hear the comment that BDS is anti-Semitic, that BDS is profoundly anti-Israel, and that any responsible politician or public commentator should wind up avoiding this. Nonsense. All three aspects of BDS are consistent and compliant with international law. The three demands of the BDS movement is to end the occupation, to enable Palestinian refugees to return, and the third one has just actually slipped my mind, but
the restoration of lost lands and property and compensation.
Yes, sorry, thank you very much for that, David. But all of this is consistent with international law, we know that the only way in which Israel is going to wind up complying with international law and undoing the occupation is when ordinary Israeli citizens wind up waking up one day and realize, gee, we now need visas to be able to fly to the United States or Europe. Gee, you know, our free trade agreements with much of the industrialized world are now being blocked and suspended because of our actions with respect to the occupation and the genocide in Gaza. That would engender a dramatic change in the worldview of Israeli political and military leaders, and we would begin to see, I think, positive steps towards the end of the occupation and real justice regarding that. Short of doing that, there's no way of persuading Israel to wind up bringing itself within compliance of international law without meaningful pressure.
And I'm reading Ilan Pappe's masterful book, Lobbying for Zionism on Both Sides of the Atlantic. And you may have read it. And reading it, it's kind of, we know about the Israeli lobby, but Pappe has really drilled down into the history of the lobby really exhaustively. And what's absolutely clear is that the state of Israel has always relied on patrons. In the beginning, it relied on the UK to establish itself. And without that support, Israel would not have come into existence, a Jewish state. And then afterwards, after the war, it relied increasingly on the United States and now effectively relies on the United States entirely. It's propped up by the United States, to a lesser extent by the European Union. And so, you know, Israel could be forced. And I'm wondering, you haven't mentioned the Chapter 7 resolution, right? The Security Council, all that needs to happen is for there to be a UN Security Council resolution under Chapter 7 telling Israel, end your war in 48 hours, and we're establishing an intervention force to replace you.
So that raises the question of the extraordinary way in which Israel is a domestic American political issue, in a way that no other foreign policy issue is with respect to the U.S. And we have to acknowledge that. And, you know, obviously the power of the Israel lobby in the United States to be able to understand why the U.S. has created such a strong alliance with Israel and backs it to continue the unlawful occupation and backs it and supplies it with arms to continue a genocide in Gaza. There's a very revealing comment in Barack Obama's presidential memoir that was published in 2020, A Promised Land, where he's waiting for a meeting in the Oval Office with his senior security advisor, Ben Rhodes. Rhodes comes into the meeting a few minutes late with Obama and apologizes. And he says, I was just got off a very long, difficult phone call with a leading Democratic lawmaker on Congress. And he said he was and he mentioned the name to Obama. And Obama said, what was the issue about? He said, it was all about settlements, Israeli settlements. And Obama said, asked him, he says, I thought he was against settlements. And Rhodes replies, he said, he is, except he doesn't want, he said he's also against us doing anything about them. And this is in many ways typical even of liberal Democrats, is that they may on occasion in Congress criticize Israel for obviously the occupation, for the way in which it's connected to the war in Gaza and so on. But there's virtually no support at all for wanting to limit, let alone end, arms trades and military supplies going to Israel, or to end the almost $4 billion a year that the United States sends to Israel in military assistance. So as long as that prevailing culture of mildly criticizing the worst excesses of a far right-wing nationalist government, combined with the unwillingness to take any meaningful steps to have Israel radically change its course and its treatment of the Palestinians within the United States, I'm afraid, you know, we're doomed to continue on this horrible path, and we're bound not to see any peace for the foreseeable future in Israel. Keep in mind this as well, you know, that with respect to the United Nations, the question of Israel and Palestine is the oldest and longest item on the agenda of the United Nations. This appeared on their agenda in April of 1947, which is, what, 78 years ago now, and it still continues there today. In his farewell speech as UN Secretary General in December 2006, Kofi Annan mentioned that this particular conflict in this relatively tiny area of geography has a resonance well beyond its borders in terms of the ripple effects politically that generate throughout the world. So this is why we pay such attention to Israel and Palestine. And it explains in part the relationship it has with the United States as to why this has remained unresolved through all these 78 years. And we're still waiting for, I guess, the ability to be able to say this is wrong and meaningful sanctions have to be applied in order to secure the peace we all want.
And for me, Michael Link, an equal indicator, revelatory situation that suggests to me that people are totally blinkered, they're completely incapable mentally of moving beyond, is their position on Hamas. That everybody says the war has to end, there has to be a ceasefire, and the war has to end, and Gaza has to be reconstructed, and Palestinians have to be allowed to live there, and more broadly, the Palestinian people need to have their state and have the right to exercise self-determination, just like everyone else. But Hamas can't be involved. Hamas has to be completely blocked out of any kind of governing situation. And I ask myself, how can a future Palestinian state, and before that, Gaza reconstructing itself, how can they exercise self-determination, some modicum of autonomy, when one of their two largest factions is not allowed to compete in the political arena by the Western powers?
Yes, look, this particular question regarding Hamas obviously has its nuances. You know, I can say I have no truck or trade with Hamas's policies or its tactical or strategic use of attacks on civilians, which violate international law. But we also know that Israel's strategy is built upon extraordinary civilian suffering to the Palestinians as well. And if Hamas is to be excluded because of its recent past actions targeting civilians, what does that say about Israel, whose targeting of civilians and whose causing of huge numbers of Palestinian civilian deaths should also then disqualify it to some degree? For those who know the insides of Palestinian politics, you know, they say it'd be impossible to try to exclude Hamas from any future reckoning within Palestinian politics, and that makes some sense to me with regards to where we go with who gets excluded and who winds being included. I know my sense is that if Hamas is excluded or is militarily defeated, that some other version of an Islamist movement will probably rise up within Palestinian politics, because that's where the issue of resistance to this cruel occupation has been the most acute. Islamic resistance has taken over the vacuum left by Fatah and secular Palestinian politics in order to be able to provide some measure of resistance to the Israeli rule. Until we have a meaningful path of diplomatic accomplishments towards a Palestinian self-determination and a meaningful Palestinian state at least in the occupied territories, your policies towards resolving the issue of Israel and Palestine are doomed to failure with respect to this. So that's my, I guess, nuanced answer as to where we go with the future of Hamas, because that's really tied up with the larger question of the future of Palestinian politics.
And of course, nobody acknowledges that Hamas, you know, came into existence in 1987, right? 40 years after the Nakba, 40 years after the Nakba, 20 years into the occupation of the Palestinian territories, didn't exist before then. And so it emerged entirely in response to and as a function of and in response to Israel's occupation. Indeed, the United States and Israel kind of helped coax it to come into existence in order to act as a foil against Fatah. So one could argue that Hamas was kind of like an Israeli creation, although that's putting it a little bit too far. They certainly rose to power in 2005 and 2006 as the result of U.S. and Israeli kind of connivance. But they exist because the conflict exists. And if the war were to end, if the UN Security Council were to tell Israel, get out of Gaza, end your war, and while you're doing that, end your occupation, I could really imagine Hamas agreeing to incorporate themselves into a national military security force and accepting Israel within 1967 borders. I can totally see that.
Look, I hear your points with respect to this. I agree that Hamas or some version of an Islamic political movement will be part of the future of Palestinian politics, and that's my central point. I'm not in favor. I prefer secular politics, but I also recognize that if you're a Democrat you have to wind up ensuring that all significant movements have a space, a democratic space in which to be able to operate, as long as they're playing by democratic rules. And for Hamas, I think they see the fact that the international community blocked their ascension to democratic power after the 2006 Palestinian elections, which virtually every major observer of the election, including the Carter Center, said were fair and free, that they had won that, and then they were blocked by the global north, and particularly led by the United States, and then this led to this extraordinary rupture in Palestinian politics, which unfortunately Palestinian democratic governance has never yet recovered from.
This is going to be this conference held in New York City in the beginning of June, co-sponsored by France and, if I'm not mistaken, Saudi Arabia. You can correct me if I'm wrong, to discuss and talk about the two-state solution. And French President Emmanuel Macron has talked about the possibility of France formally accepting, acknowledging Palestinian statehood at that time, which would be pretty amazing. Are you aware of this conference happening at the beginning of June, and do you see anything useful coming out of it?
I understand.